Joining us for this edition of Track Record on Share Radio is Campbell McPherson. He's a business advisor, speaker and writer with a background in strategy implementation, in HR and in marketing. He's most recently the author of The Change Catalyst, Secrets to Successful and Sustainable Business Change, written after many years of working with companies, with organisations, with individuals on the implementation of change management. Campbell McPherson, it's so good of you to join us here on Track Record on Share Radio.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
How do you best like to be described these days?
My multifaceted career has ended up as a speaker, writer, author and business advisor. So.
You're not alone in people whom we've spoken to in that ilk, in that field, whose background lies elsewhere. But when you dig into that background, you can see that actually their progression probably would have taken them in the business direction in which they eventually went. Now, your career is actually in the military. That's where you started. Tell me about those early days.
Well, yes, when you say it's in the military, I did start in the Air Force, but I was...
Does that sound too highfalutin, does it?
It certainly does, for someone that's marching around in blue overalls, painting rocks white for a living. Yes, it sounds a little bit highfalutin.
So tell me about your motivations for joining the Air Force. And in those early days, when you were young and greener, could you have done something completely different, maybe?
Absolutely. The choice was between doing a mix of science and law at Brisbane University. I went to school up in Maroochydore at Maroochydore High School on the gloriously named Sunshine Coast in Queensland. And it was a great school that specialised in two things, really. And it was teenage pregnancies and surfing. And seeing I was fairly rubbish at both of those, I just concentrated on teaching myself chemistry and getting through the syllabus. So I ended up going into the Air Force. It's a good question. Why? I'm not sure. I think it was a very good friend of mine badly wanted to join the Royal Australian Air Force Academy because it was so hard to get into. And so I just applied as well. And so I ended up finding myself marching around an airbase just off the sewerage farm outside of Melbourne and learning how to fly planes very badly.
And what of your learning process in those early days? Did you acquire anything of value? I know that it gave you a bit of an interest in leadership, and it gave you the...
No, it did. It was my first introduction to leadership and management where the Air Force had some brilliant materials that was presented by one of the squadron leaders to all these young officer cadets. And it was fantastic material on collaboration and leading by example and setting a culture whereby people were happy to question and consensus, except, of course, back in 1981, Royal Australian Air Force, none of those things were put into practice. It was all very much command and control. And if you had more stripes on your shoulder, then you simply told people what to do and they did it. So when I pointed this out to the red-haired, mustachioed squadron leader who was teaching us, he decided I would stay on base and paint rocks for the whole weekend as well. Actually, I did learn quite a few things in the Air Force. One was how to open a beer bottle with another one. The other one was how to actually iron shirts with an inch of their life. But the other really important one was from an English tutor who modelled himself in every way. That's the stature, mannerisms, voice, everything on Winston Churchill. And he said the secret to business communication, ironically coming from the Air Force, was to tell them what you're going to tell them, and then tell them what you told them. And weirdly enough, 30-odd years later, that's exactly what I do every single time I sit down to write an article, give a presentation. So I owe it to Australia's mock Winston for those words of wisdom.
Sounds simple, but yet effective. And are you still good at razor-sharp seams? I rather fancy that you might be.
Do you know what? My wife refuses to iron anything for me anymore because I said, no, I'm going to have to do that again. That was terrible.
And the day that you decided to leave the Air Force, you say that you walked into your instructor's office and you said,
yes,
right, I'm going to resign. And his response was simply, oh, thank goodness for that.
No, it was. It was indeed. In fact, I was the world's worst pilot. I think it had something to do with the fact that my eyesight deteriorated so badly in the first couple of years that I had to memorise the eye chart to keep flying. Actually, CLEDHBTVO was the bottom line, if you're ever interested in applying for the Air Force.
Isn't the human mind wonderful?
Yes, it's madness. But yes, I snapped a salute and said, "Excuse me, sir." And he said, "Yes, Cadet McPherson." I said, "I'd like to resign." He said, "Oh, thank God for that."
And on that note, your first track record choice rather hints at that early aviation career that I didn't get so far. Those Magnificent Men in Their Flying Machines. Is this a piece of music that you look on and listen to with a degree of fondness now?
I do. I think it's got the... Obviously, it was a bit before 1981, but the choice was between that one that is delightfully silly and something from Top Gun that would have just been taking myself far too seriously.
You're listening to Track Record on Share Radio. The musical choices and CV chat come from Campbell McPherson, whose latest project is The Change Catalyst. And Campbell, at some point soon, we will come on to the nuts and bolts of that particular book. But it sounds to me already that the book is really a summary of all the good things and perhaps some of the bad that you've learned and experienced along the way in business.
Yes, it is. It's a summary of really the last 30-odd years of helping CEOs and leaders to articulate their strategy and align their organisations to deliver change. And there are six parts of the book, but it goes through why 88% of change fails, which is a frightening statistic. And then it goes through one of the essential ingredients to change. And fundamentally, it's about leadership and people.
So tell me how an early career and a relatively short-lived one in the Royal Australian Air Force leads you to a career in computing sales and marketing?
Well, that's a very, very good question. And when I worked out that I really was a shocking pilot and had joined an aviation company for a year after leaving the Air Force, I thought, what do I want to do? So I opened up the business papers and said, well, what is hot? And this was 1984. And I thought, computers. Fabulous. I've got a science degree. Why don't I get into that? So I started working for NCR and then Ultimate Computers and then ultimately starting Australia's first ever interactive multimedia agency, which we creatively called Intermark.
And was there something of a great excitement and the unknown territory of selling and marketing products which were so new, so advanced and advancing all of the time during the 80s and the early to mid-1990s?
Yes, it was very exciting. Our first product was a 3.5-inch floppy disk electronic brochure with all of 16 colours to be able to deliver. And somehow we managed to squeeze an interactive action-oriented interactive brochure onto those floppy disks, and we attracted the likes of Apple, American Express, Zurich, Pfizer, AXA, Nissan actually put one of their disks on advertising the Nissan Maxima car onto the front cover of Business Review Weekly, which was Australia's biggest business magazine. So it was very exciting. The term multimedia hadn't even been invented when we'd started the company in 92. One of our biggest excitements, and in the end, biggest disappointments in a sense, was we built an interactive golf tutorial. That sort of thing hadn't been done before that was truly interactive. And we got Nick Price to actually headline it. And we creatively, again, called it Nick Price's Troubleshooting Golf. Within an hour, he had sold 50,000 copies of our tutorial. And I remember my partner and I are on the other end of the phone and we're jumping for joy because we were going to get, I think it was about $11 a copy. So there was a good $500,000 coming our way. 2 months later, the LA earthquake struck. Actually, I think it was a month or so later in January of 94. And our distributor's office was buried in the rubble in LA. We sent the Austrade investigators out to have a look, and they said, sorry, the office doesn't exist anymore, and we never heard of the distributor again.
When you're flying high to such an extent, and for whatever reason it comes crashing down in the world of business, how on earth do you pick yourself up, dust yourself off, and find a route heading forward again?
There just needs to be either one of two things. One is an inner belief that, oh, well, I'll have learnt from that. Let's now move on. I don't know what I've learnt from that now. It's too raw, but I'm sure I'll have learned something in the years to come. Mm-hmm. And the other ends up being necessity. I mean, once you have my life, or the life of a change catalyst, if you like, is very much one of a roller coaster. So when you actually are at the bottom of the trough, you just have to believe that things are, frankly, they're going to go up. One of the parts of the book that I talk about is the inevitability of change and how change is accelerating. The change we have coped with over the last 50 years is significant. The change we have all embraced and managed and coped with over the last 20 is quite astronomical, but it's nothing compared to the change in the next 20 years that we will all have to cope with. So it's not just coping with, because I think that those of us who are able to cope with the change will survive, but those of us who are able to seek out and embrace change, the new way of doing things, will really thrive. And I think that's the secret. And in it, I talk about entrepreneurs. You know, we're all becoming entrepreneurs now. It's gone are the days when we have a job for life. You know, well and truly gone are those. I think there's a statistic that I'm reading the book that I put in the book that on average today, people in their 40s have had about 14 different jobs in different companies. Now, even 20 years ago, that was seen as being flaky and impossible. Now that's the norm. Kids can start leaving university, taking one direction, and they'll have a dozen or more different careers throughout their life. And I think that's very powerful.
You are already hinting at the defining subject, of course, of the book, and a lot of the basis upon which you speak to individuals and organisations around the globe as well. We'll get on that in just a few minutes. But your next track record choice is Jean-Michel Jarre. Tell us about the track and why you've chosen it.
Well, I chose that to represent when I'd got into computers, because it was one of the first major worldwide hits that was done purely on what was a computer back in the 70s, but a Moog synthesizer. And it just takes me back to a very fun time where Chrysler Chargers were all the rage in Australia, and this track was just incredibly popular.
You're listening to Track Record on Share Radio. And joining us on this edition is Campbell McPherson, who's alongside a business advisor, speaker, writer, the author of The Change Catalyst, Secrets to Successful and Sustainable Business Change. Shall we talk about the people, about getting the people right and getting the people in the right place in an organisation? No matter how big, no matter how small, it's the sum total of the human beings that work in a place, I reckon, that makes a business successful.
Completely. I mean, Louis Gerstner, who used to be the CEO of IBM, said a rather outrageous but accurate statement, which was culture is everything. And to be perfectly blunt, culture is everything. If you only your people can deliver your strategy. So if a leader is going to be taking their organization through change, it needs to be all about the people. They need to have they understand what drives their people, need to understand that emotions beat logic every time. They trump logic every single time. In fact, emotions are four times more powerful than logic as a motivator. So without your people engaged in what are they trying to achieve, what is the organization trying to achieve, why is the organization trying to achieve this, and engaged in understanding what the implications of this change are and the best ways to implement it, change will simply never happen. So to me, it's all about clarity, it's all about people, and it's all about culture. And that's probably why only about 12% of change initiatives actually deliver the outcomes they set out to achieve, because leaders forget the people.
And clarity isn't a hard thing to find. Often it can be easily within reach.
That's interesting you say that, because so many organisations find it to be completely the opposite. So the clarity is quite tough to nail down for a lot of leaders. Mm. And perhaps, as one CEO, actually not CEO, sorry, one leader of a financial services institution said to me only a couple of years ago, he said, "Campbell, why would you have me set a target that I may not achieve?"
And your response was?
I laughed. I thought, I'm not quite sure what to say to that one. But I understand where he was going, where he was coming from. I understand that if you set the wrong target and then you slavishly set out to achieve that with and it might have been the incorrect target to start with, then you end up having a whole plethora of behaviours that are counterproductive. Yeah. But my response after I considered it, I went back into his office and said, "But we're not talking about a dogmatic achievement of a number. We're talking about setting out a picture of what we're trying to achieve, being able to measure that, and continually asking yourself the question of, is that the outcome we're looking for?"
I suppose what I was getting at before is that often with a lot of organisations, what is wrong, if you want to use the W word, what is wrong with an organisation, sometimes it doesn't run so deep. Sometimes it's not that fundamental. Sometimes it might be just one or two things that need to tweak.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yes, I agree entirely.
And maybe organisations do worry that they're getting it so wrong, whereas actually they're only getting it a little bit wrong, and it just maybe takes a little shift in a bit of corporate policy sometimes instead of wholesale change, which is what they're scared of.
Actually, that's a very, very, very good point. It's the old 80-20 rule. There's normally a couple of key things to do with structured decision making or maybe even incentives that could unlock a great deal of... actually, I just had a massage this morning. It would be like unlocking the muscle, and suddenly freeing it up to move properly.
I'm not surprised at all to see that in your CV you spent a couple of years in the late 1990s with Anderson Consulting. And interestingly, you say that it was probably your first formal experience in what you call the art and science of organisational change. And it really captured your imagination.
Yes, it did. Before that, I'd been doing flying and selling floppy disks and creating new industries and doing some very exciting things. But this was about what Anderson Consulting was quite brilliant at doing, was taking large organisations and helping them to change, either to merge or to acquire or to cut staff. But it was the detailed thinking of their methodology of why and how organisations should change that I thought was fabulous. And that was one of the big reasons for joining them. And actually, I learnt a lot from it was only 2 years in the end at Anderson Consulting, but I also learnt a lot of what they weren't doing. So that I certainly learnt that change was tough, but I also learnt that it entirely depends on a company's ability to engage their people in the change. And that was one of the things that big firm back in the 90s wasn't doing. They were doing a lot of process, they were doing a lot of tick box, they were doing a lot of talking, but not a lot of engaging of the people in the organization. So I certainly learned that. I learned about the power of clarity. To be honest, I thought when I came into Anderson Consulting and saw the plethora of chevrons, I thought they were just baffling people with jargon. But actually, their intellectual property was brilliant. It was just not conveyed in a way that normal humans could understand. I remember standing on a stage in the States where Anderson Consulting was Chicago, where they were based, and I was there to present the program management methodology of the firm to some new, very bright young things who have just started. And I was up till 3 a.m. trying to understand the program management methodology of the firm beforehand. Then I finally worked out, if you actually switched things around, added a little word in, and made sure one of the words was a verb, it all suddenly started to make sense. So it wasn't program management, it was managing the program.
Isn't that common across so many sectors in business that there's a bit of deliberate obfuscation?
That's a delightful
in
a, term.
In any industry. I'm not entirely sure, I think, in my mind, why that's the case, or maybe using what seems like industry-specific jargon somehow renders you more intellectual or capable at the job and industry in hand. But you imagine a lot of people working in organisations where they don't even understand their own organisations speak a lot of the time.
Without a doubt. I've spent most of the last 20 years in financial services, so you don't need to tell me anything about that.
Let's hear your next track record choices before we delve any deeper. And you've gone for Don't Stop by Fleetwood Mac. Now, this is a 1980s vintage track.
Yes, it was. It was one of the first concerts I went to, actually, or gigs I went to. I was aged 14 in 1977 in Brisbane, and this band that I'd never heard of, I thought they were American, I found out they're mainly English, appeared on stage, and I was just blown away. And I thought, given the fact, when I was reflecting on doing this interview with you about the earthquake completely destroying my $500,000. But I thought, what did we do? We had to pick ourselves up and get going. So I thought it was an appropriate thing.
This is Track Record on Share Radio. The author of The Change Catalyst is alongside Campbell McPherson. You may know him otherwise as a business advisor, a speaker, and a writer too, and someone who immerses themselves in organisations and organisational change and process all across the globe. Now, those of a sharp ear will hear that you still have that Southern Hemisphere twang to your accent. So at some point in your timeline, at some point in your life, you've decided to make the UK your home. What prompted you to come to this country?
A gorgeous girl I met in a pub in Sydney back in 1991. It's always a girl somewhere along the line. But anyway, we got married in 92, and then 7 years later, she turned around to me and said, I only came here backpacking. I've now got a husband and two kids. I'd like to go back to England, please. So,
was there an attraction above and beyond the fact that your wife was from here and was buying the plane tickets already? did you set your sights on a career somewhere along the lines of what you've been doing at Anderson Consulting in the UK?
Well, yes, without a doubt. In fact, it was with Andersons that I moved over to London. What I wanted to do was to not so much get out of Australia, but to become more international and more global. Australia is a wonderful, wonderful place. And Sydney is about as international as it gets in the Southern Hemisphere. But to start working in London was something that I always wanted to do.
You find that we were a little bit backward in our approach to the internet, and some surprising big corporate names were very hesitant to embrace the internet. In some cases, didn't see its value, perhaps, back in the 1990s, where you say at the time, actually, Australia, what you could compare it to, was leading the way in many ways.
Very much so. It was 99 when we moved here, and I was used to online shopping, online supermarket shopping. Australian supermarkets delivered. Everything was done online. You didn't have to talk to anyone. It was actually done online via a browser, not via a floppy disk. Online banking was normal. I'm paying all my bills through the internet. I hardly ever used cash. You could pay everything from taxis to just anything with a credit card or debit card. Pins were in. It was all very, very together in 99. And then I arrived over here, and the Tesco and RBS handed me a CD-ROM that I didn't know what to do with, and a cabbie threatened to deck me when I handed over my Amex to pay for a fare. Yes, it was a little bit different. But I came over here with what was Anderson Consulting to really head up the AMP Group's new e-business section. But they had AMP was Australia's largest insurer. They'd invaded this country and snapped up a host of companies at what actually turned out to be rather disastrously high prices, but they bought Pearl Insurance and NPI, Henderson Investors, Cogent, London Life, and 50% of Virgin Direct, which became important for my next career move. But it was fascinating that they just wanted me to go around and evangelize about the internet and help them change, help them to change, to understand the opportunities of this new online world. And it was it was remarkable. I spent 6 months as an evangelist before then actually getting into some change management work or change leadership work with the AMP Group.
And as an evangelist, yes, in your word, the language that you use and the methods by which you encourage people to have an interest and then buy into the idea, how do you get at people? How do you get into organisations and persuade them that you got to be in it?
Well, it's a combination of
things. When they're so resistant, I mean, where is the chink? Is it finding a chink?
Definitely. I was just going to say, it's two ways. One is there needs to be a logical reason for the organisation to consider this new way of doing things. But there also needs to be an emotional reason for the organisation to be doing it. But more importantly, so you've got the organisation's motives, but you've got to understand and find out what the motives are for each of the individual leaders and members of the leadership team in each one of these organisations. So they need to be motivated emotionally. They need to be motivated logically as well. It's got to be something in it for them.
Yeah. It's no good just saying, here's the evidence that shows that this works somewhere else. There's no use in saying, in Australia, this is big.
Oh, do you know what? That's the worst thing you could possibly say.
The evidence is so clear sometimes that people can't maybe see it or are somehow still suspicious of how it's working.
It's a very strong not invented here syndrome in any country, to be perfectly honest. Oh yes, it works in Australia, but it certainly won't work here. Only a few years ago I was in Hong Kong.
You sound like someone who's had that thrown at you so many times in your career.
All the time. Oh well, actually
it works for them but not us.
Exactly.
That fits with their corporate vision but not ours.
Yeah, precisely.
Yeah.
Oh, no, that's totally different.
Is that always the first
excuse? We're in
the
wholesale financial services, not retail financial services. It's just the first excuse. No, I do agree.
It sounds like you're more than capable of batting that one away now.
Well, laughter helps. Companies are led by individuals. And interestingly, once you unlock their desire for change, then you can try and point out to them that you now have to do the same thing for every single one of the people who are going to follow you, because you know the challenge you've just had in coming around to, you know what, yes, we need to be heading in this direction. They're going to go through the same process.
I think I know the answer to this question, but tell us why your next track record choice is London Calling by The Clash.
Yeah, Jane.
London calling to the faraway towns. Now war is declared. Boys and girls.
and the crunch of pain. The ice is coming, the sun's zooming in. Meltdown expected, the wheat is going thin. Engines stop running, but I have no fear, cause London is drowning. I live by the river, to the imitation zone. Forget it, brother, you can go it alone. London calling to the zombies of death. Quit holding out and draw another breath. London calling, and I don't want to shout, but while we were talking, I saw you nodding out. London calling, see, we ain't got no hide, except for that one with the yellowy eyes. The ice age is coming, the sun's zooming in. Engines stop running, the wheat is going thick. A nuclear error, but I have no fear, cause London is drowning. And I live by the river.
You're listening to Track Record on Share Radio. Alongside on this edition is Campbell McPherson, who's with us, the author of The Change Catalyst, Secrets to a Successful and Sustainable Business Change. But you'll note his name as a speaker, as a writer in other areas, and as a business advisor as well. We talked a little bit about your business and professional career so far, starting off in the military to start with via Anderson Consulting. And you've got some other noted organisations on your past CV as well. You joined Virgin Wines very early on too.
Well, that was the start of a series of new jobs where I just simply said yes to everyone who tapped me on the shoulder. But this was very exciting. It was a fellow by the name of Rowan Gormley, who used to run Virgin Direct. He was the initial CEO. He is now running Majestic, actually. He's now the CEO of Majestic Wines. He tapped me on the shoulder and said, I've got some money from Richard Branson. I'm going to go off and start an online wine business. Remember, this was 2000 and online retailing had really only just started. Mm-hmm. And having been on the other end of my evangelizing about the internet, he thought I could help. So when he offered me the job of founding marketing director, I jumped at it. And so there were about five of us sitting around a big whiteboard. There was Rowan, his brother, and three of his top lieutenants, two of his top lieutenants and me. And we just designed the Virgin Wine system experience from scratch on one whiteboard. And it was a fabulous experience. But I learned quite a few things from that. I ended up only being at Virgin Wines for about a year because I was tapped on the shoulder again. But I learned a couple of things. One particularly was that the importance of implications and the importance of planning and stress testing the operations. Because our launch, not down to any brilliant marketing skills of myself, but the launch was so successful because it was Virgin, because it was wine, I think, and also probably to do with the buy one, get one free in terms of buy a case and get one free that we actually launched with. But it was so popular that our operations couldn't actually cope with it, and it completely collapsed, and we'd promised to deliver. And people listening who are first Virgin Wines customers will remember this. We promised to deliver with 3 days or delivery was free. And 3 weeks went by. And I remember driving all around the country looking in obscure warehouses for missing cases of wine. So I learned two things. One was the importance of planning. And the other was how to turn a disaster into a triumph, because we looked after the customers that we'd let down so badly that many years on, we looked after them so well that many years on, they were still with the company and they were the most loyal customers that Virgin Wines actually had.
And that, again, is something I know you really focus on in the book as well, is when things aren't going so well. In fact, when things are in the pits of disaster, how to pull back, how not to necessarily write off and walk away. Do you think sometimes companies are afraid to face up to mistakes?
You need a change really culture if you're going to be one of the 12% of change initiatives that actually succeed. And one of the parts of that, one of the key components of a change really culture, is to make sure that your people are encouraged to challenge the status quo, and they're encouraged to find new ways of doing things. But more importantly, they're encouraged to try and fail and learn from their mistakes and move on. I've been in many organizations where to fail is to be completely wiped out. You don't get a second chance if you fail. And while that's not what the leaders say, it's what the culture has developed that people who fail end up being sidelined. So therefore, no one ends up making decisions. Back here, we'll come to a stage in my life where I accidentally ended up being HR director for quite a large firm, and this was. The culture that I'd inherited was a complete blame culture. So everyone was pointing the fingers at one another, and no one was ever making a decision.
And it just goes around in a little vortex, doesn't it, in that situation? OK, we'll let you tell that story next on Track Record on Share Radio. After Savage Garden with Affirmation, why, Campbell, is this on your Track Record list?
Well, my wife was the head of sponsorships for Westpac, a rather big Australian bank, in fact, Australia's first bank, and one of her big coups was to win the bid to be the bank of the Olympics. The Olympics for the Sydney Olympics was in 2000. We moved here in 99, so as we were watching Savage Garden play at the opening, I think it was, or the closing ceremony of the Olympics, she was in tears and just turned around to me and said, "I'm so sorry, we had seats to this."
Listening to Track Record on Share Radio. The conversation and the music choices come from Campbell McPherson on this edition. He's the author of The Change Catalyst, which is very new and shiny and out now, and a bit of a read for anybody really who's in a managerial role, a senior role. But actually, it's not a bad read for anybody who works in business and anybody who has ambition.
It's just a damn good read, to be perfectly honest.
For anybody who has ambition and wants to do well, I guess, in their sphere of business. Now, you talked about accidental positions along the way and being tapped on the shoulder, and it sounds like you're the kind of person who, you don't need someone giving you the hard sell on a new position, but you're able to consider it for what it is. Along the way, have people had to really work hard for your time and attention?
Well, that's very flattering. That's a lovely way to put it. I think I just get attracted by the next shiny new bauble that is dangled in front of me. But it's been an interesting career where I haven't done a marketing degree and was offered the job of marketing director three times. I'd never been in HR, and then, as I said, was accidentally found myself being offered the role of HR director, which was, I think, one of the best things I've ever done. I didn't realise HR was so tough. Yeah. I used to spend my career dodging the HR department. It was a bit like getting an unexpected call from the police. You know, you're not guilty of anything, but for a split second you wonder that maybe there was something you'd done. So, no, I was working with Mysis, that was at the time as the UK's largest IT company, and was helping them to re-engineer their sales force. And then they had acquired five different IFA networks. They are their independent financial advisors, the guys that sell your mortgages and help you plan your pensions. They bought five networks and wanted to squish them into to one squish. It's a technical term, into one organisation. So I was hired with a few other people to help them do this. And so after we'd done that and created one company out of five, they asked me to stay on, and I said, sure, what would you like me to do? And they said, well, we'd like you to join the board. And I said, okay. I said, what as? And they said, HR director. And I should have waited a split second for my brain to engage, but instead I just blurted out, what? HR? That's the one thing not on my CV. But it was one of the best experiences of my life. We ended up with a few brilliant HR professionals that were sort of buried in the organisation. We ended up transforming this error-prone department into an award-winning example of how HR could add value, and we turned it into the driver for change. We went through lots of organisational changes. We span off parts of the organisation. We transformed the culture from a blame culture to one obsessed with delivery of outcomes and clarity of accountability. And I've taken all those learnings from that time, which was, gosh, about 15 years ago now, into every single assignment and organisation that I've worked for since. It was brilliant.
Because it's the one part of a company that's all about the people and the management of the people.
It is, yeah. but the secret is to make sure that culture is not the HR director's job. Culture is the CEO's job. It's all of the leadership's job, and probably that was the best thing I was able to achieve there. It wasn't just hire an HR director and they'll do the people stuff. It's the people stuff is your job. You can't achieve your strategy without your people. They're the only ones that can deliver it.
Is this also a good example of urging people to never say never when an opportunity comes their way? Not to discount themselves from something that they feel they don't necessarily have experience of, that isn't on their CV, but nonetheless they can make an absolutely good fist of.
Well, I think it's even better than that. The reason that I was asked to be HR director of this firm was because I hadn't been in HR before. It was because it was a commercial executive, but who understood culture, understood organisation design, and could just get people, engage people to help them deliver. So the great thing about not being steeped in that profession is that I could ask all of the daft questions that someone who had been there in HR for 20 years would have been too embarrassed to ask. Mm. So it was a case of I couldn't get into the detail. The ingrained desire to micromanage that we all have was impossible because I didn't know the detail. I knew the outcomes we needed to achieve, and I had to engage, work with my team to get them done. So it really was the best learning experience.
Yeah, and I'm sure this is sage advice for people in business everywhere, but in this role particularly, you weren't afraid to call on expertise from people in the field.
No.
And to go seek that best practice elsewhere.
Yeah.
And often I think as individuals and organisations, we're afraid to do that outside our own walls, aren't we?
Leaders particularly think they have to have all the answers, and they don't. I think one of the best words to think of when going through implementing a major strategy, going through a major change, a merger, an acquisition, the word to remember is genuine. You've just got to be genuine, not just come across as genuine, but be genuine. And no one genuinely expects a leader to have all the answers. And that's something that a lot of leaders forget.
And it's okay to say, I don't know the answer.
Yes, it is. It is.
I'll go find it out, but I don't know the answer. Your next track record choice is the rather marvellous Vivaldi, Spring from the Four Seasons. Why this?
Well, there's a real reason and a right reason for everything, particularly in the world of business, particularly when it comes to change, having to get the change word in. The right reason for this is that it's the track that we signed that we got married to, that we signed the registry. But Jane only told me that yesterday. I hadn't remembered it. The real reason is that the next step in my career was to go and work for Zurich. And Zurich is an extremely cultured and ordered and orderly organisation and city. So I thought a bit of classical music that also has a bit of change in it would be apt.
Thank you.
You're listening to Track Record on Share Radio. Alongside us, Campbell McPherson, who joins us, business advisor, speaker, writer, and author of The Change Catalyst. Now, we've used the change word rather a lot in this in this conversation, and you say that your appointment at Zurich was change central. Was it quite unlike any other place, any other position until then you previously had held?
Yes, it was. Yes, it was. It was, as I said, I'd been a marketing director, HR director, and now this role was strategy director for Zurich Global Life across the emerging markets division that included Middle East, Asia, Latin America, and Central and Eastern Europe. So suddenly to find myself as strategy director of one of the largest life insurers and retail investment organizations in the world was a wonderful situation to be in, and joined at a time where it was all about growth. It was they'd been through the batten down the hatches phase, and this was all about the growth phase. So we were opening up new offices in new countries. We were launching new propositions. We're transforming sales forces, in-house sales forces, into independent IFAs. We were forging new partnerships with banks across the world. It was very, very exciting.
It sounds breathtaking.
Oh, it really was. It was very exciting. All from some little offices in Reading and the Isle of Man.
And I'm reading a very interesting point that you make on values and Zurich's values at the time, that you don't hold back on this at all, do you? You say they were workshopped, superficial nonsense. I just have this vision of people writing things down on a flip chart that somehow made it into corporate policy that you took a blunderbuss to.
Well, yes, it wasn't as overt or a bull in a china shop as that at the time. The fact that they were, as you say, workshop superficial nonsense was what we whispered in the corridors rather than yelled from the top of the building. But there's a new CEO now, and Mario is fabulous if he's listening, he'll certainly is there to turn Zurich around. But at the time, I learnt a lot about values with Zurich, because there was a couple of values that they'd workshopped and that they'd written up beautifully. As you alighted from the lifts of the morning, you would see customer centricity and integrity stare down at you from the ceilings. The problem with them, though, is they weren't genuine. And in writing this part of the book that I've cheekily called Values Schmalus, this part of the book is where I've worked out there are three types of value that every organization should identify. And the leader should spend time identifying these three types. One is your brand values, which is actually what your customers say they are. Mm-hmm. Now, that's fairly obvious, but a lot of the times the brand values are what the CEO or the marketing director thinks they should be. They're not the brand values at all. Your corporate values aren't what your CEO says they are. They're what your people say they are. So you've got brand values, ask your customers. Corporate values, what are they? Ask your people. Now, the third set are aspirational values. Now, that's what the leadership team would actually like them to be. So that's what the almost developmental values. We know what our brand values are today. We know what our corporate values are today, but we aspire to have these values. No company I've ever worked for or delved into, and I've worked for a lot of companies in a variety of ways, ever look at values through these three lenses. And I think if they did, that would be very, very, very exciting, because the values you put in your annual report are often aspirational values, but your staff will look at them and your customers look at them and go, well, values are genuine and therefore we're genuinely wanting to aspire to these ones that we put in our annual report, then you'd end up with a culture that has a damn good chance of delivering your strategy. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure, you know, financial performance would inevitably ensue. There's a wonderful saying that I can't remember where I got it from, and I don't know if it's a Japanese proverb or an Arabic one, but it's strategy without execution is a daydream. Execution without strategy is a nightmare. And I think the two have to go together.
I would have been very disappointed indeed had David Bowie's Changes not made your track record list.
Yes.
And I'm pleased to say that in Almost at the Last is that particular track, of course, from a world-renowned and sadly missed artist. Tell me why it is also something of a personal soundtrack for you.
It was a track that we used to listen to at school and university quite a bit. It takes me back to those. But the main reason is because from the time from this time, and then of course moving on to writing the book about change, it just seemed to be the perfect track.
Not so sweet, so I turned myself to face me. But I've never caught a glimpse of how the others must see the faker. I'm much too fast to take that test.
Change,
turn and face the strange.
Change,
don't wanna be a richer man.
This is Track Record on Share Radio, the conversation led on this particular edition by Campbell McPherson, business advisor, writer, speaker, author of The Change Catalyst. Now, it somehow, I'm sure, was inevitable that somewhere along the way you would leave corporate life as you'd known it behind at some point and set up by yourself, all that accumulated experience. Probably was always going to manifest itself in your own organisation. At what point did you decide that the time was right to set up Campbell McPherson and Associates?
Yes, well, that happened in 2011. It was Zurich had been going through quite a few changes, and it was a culmination of events. One of them was actually meeting with someone who became my first client when I set up the firm, which was a wonderful CEO from a US company called iPipeline that is transforming the life insurance industry in the US. It was an accidental meeting over a breakfast. They thought they were meeting. They didn't know what I did. They thought that somehow I was. They were meeting with a venture capitalist organization where it was part of Zurich that I was working for at the time. It was a complete misnomer. And they said, "Oh, sorry, Campbell, sorry to waste your time." And I said, no, what are you looking to achieve? And they said, "We want to get into the UK business and we want someone who understands the IFA and distribution part of the UK. We're looking to hire someone as a consultant to do that." And I said, "Bear with me, get back to me in another month, and I think we can do a deal." So I thought that was just a sign that I should make the move. And it was, I must admit, it was fabulous. It was about 3 years that I was running my own firm, which has recently been resumed. I suppose it was just put on hold. But we had some great clients. We did some great work with CoFunds, with State Street, with IFDS, which is the largest mutual fund administrator in the UK with Aviva Friends Life. It was a good time.
You've given us so many hints, and I hope not given away absolutely everything in the book, The Change Catalyst, which is out at the moment. But thank you so much for sharing the conversation with us and choosing some great tunes on Track Record as well, Campbell McPherson. Your last is Louis Armstrong's What a Wonderful World. Tell me, why this?
Well, the big reason for this, the main reason, is that this was my wife's father's favourite track. He sadly died when Jane was 14, and I never got to know him. And so that's a good enough reason in itself. But the other reason is it's just a delightful, positive emotion that comes through in the track, and it's about looking at the world and not switching on the news and seeing all the horrible things that are happening, but actually sitting back and thinking, what a wonderful world it is.
Campbell McPherson, thank you.
Thank you. It's been an absolute pleasure.
I see trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world. I see skies of blue and clouds of white, the bright blessed day, the dark sacred night. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Track Record with Sue Dugan.